The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com, and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Hannah Devlin. Coming up on the show, how are social algorithms shaping our lives? Does Facebook make it harder for liberals and conservatives to get along? And are personalised search results on Google helpful, or do they keep us trapped in an echo chamber defined by our own narrow interests? Plus, how our immune system's activity changes with the seasons, and scientists' take on the dress that some of us see as blue and black and others see as white and gold. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. A recent study by Facebook's in-house research team investigated whether the social network's newsfeed was helping keep people in political bubbles by selectively serving up news designed to match their own views while filtering out content from opposite political camps. This personalised view of the internet, provided by social algorithms that guess what we want to see, is known as the filter bubble. The filter can relate to politics, the news, products you're sold, and even the prices you pay for them. Joining me down the line is David Lazar, Professor of Political Science and Computer Science at Northeastern University, and Professor Vincent Hendricks, Director of the Centre for Information and Bubble Studies at the University of Copenhagen. And in the studio is The Guardian science editor, Ian Sample. Welcome to all of you. We've always created social and political bubbles for ourselves to some degree, but the filter bubble is quite a new idea, and it's based on the idea that social algorithms are bolstering this effect. It's been quite a controversial point of discussion. It feels as though we're just starting to get data that can shed light on the extent to which this is happening, including the study last week that came out from Facebook. David, you weren't involved in the research, but you've written about it. Would you be able to take us through the details?
Sure. This study from Facebook was examining how the news feed is sorted by Facebook and how that affects what people see and what they read. So many people don't realize this, but they don't see everything that could appear in their news feed. That is, just because your friend posted something doesn't mean that it pops up on your news feed. Facebook has a set of algorithms as computer programs that are sorting this and saying, I think Hannah's going to find this more interesting and engaging than that, so we'll put this at the top of the list. One concern that has been raised is that in the political sphere, where at least in the United States and arguably in the UK as well, there is increased political polarization. The concern has been raised that our socio-technical systems like Facebook and Google and other kinds of systems that are on the internet are somehow shaping what we see so that we only see things that we agree with. And so in this study, the researchers from Facebook examined three questions. The first is whether our friends tend to agree with us ideologically. The second is to what extent does the algorithm, the computational sorting of the content, tend to prioritize things that you are inclined to agree with? And then the third is, are users more likely to click on content that they agree with? And so what they found was, first of all, that people are strongly predisposed to be friends with others who have similar ideological tendencies, although not exclusively so. So there is some cross-cutting information that occurs, just that, let's say, a large majority of people that we're friends with are similar to us ideologically. The second result was that they found that there's a substantial tendency for people to click on stuff that they are inclined to agree with. And then they do find that there is an algorithmic sorting and prioritization of content that you will be inclined to agree with, but that effect is not as large as the first two effects.
Right. So in Britain, for example, we've just had the general election. When I look at my own Facebook feed, I definitely feel that there's quite a strong political slant in one direction. Does that mean it's probably due to my selection of friends and maybe the friends that I enjoy reading things from most, rather than Facebook itself that is filtering out one half of the political argument?
It's likely a combination of the two, but their results suggest that it would be more the fact that your friends are predisposed to have the same political views as you do. And this is something that has been known in the field of political communication since the 1940s, that we experience something called political homophily. That is, we tend to be friends with people who are similar to ourselves politically. But this result suggests that it is possible that this is also in part because the Facebook is prioritizing content that you would agree with. I should note that their study was not a study of the UK. They might find different things in the UK. Maybe there's a bigger filter bubble in the UK than there is in the US. And I should also note that they only looked at 10 million users in the US who self-identify ideologically. And so one also has to examine if this result generalizes to the 200 or so million users in the US who did not, most of whom did not self-identify ideologically.
I'd be interested in your take on this, Vince, because you've studied all sorts of bubbles, economic bubbles, bubbles around news content. Do you think there's something different about social media, or do you think this suggests we can just relax about it?
Well, as they also say in the paper that we were referring to before that David was so brilliantly actually just recombing from. Now, this has been known for some time, as David is also saying, namely that we tend to polarize and we tend to shift our opinions to people that we agree with on the whole. What is significant about this study is that the narrative out there has been that this has probably been much more dominant than it actually, in this particular study, turns out to be. So one of some of the narratives that we've heard also about Google and Facebook and other sorting algorithms is that they, to a large extent, actually determine what we will click on, how our behavior will be on the web, and so forth and so far. And this study relaxes this concern to some extent, but also in a population that is not very big. I mean, Telmian uses a lot of users, of course, but as David also pointed out, not a very, very significant number. Now, clearly, what we should concern ourselves about also is the fact that one of the things that we have gotten with the social media, which is a very recent thing, realize that that our experience with these sorts of things doesn't date much more back than 10 years. Facebook just had its 10-year anniversary, so it's a relatively new thing for us. And one of the things that we can do now, being users on social media, is that we can easily and cost-neutrally register our opinion on the web. And we can do that politically, ideologically, religiously, socially. We could do it pertaining to gaining social capital or giving social capital. So every like or upvote or other upvote gestures may actually be looked as if, to a certain extent, as an investment of your opinion or your stance or whatever you have. And it doesn't cost us much to do it. And in and by itself, it's insignificant. But what it might not be insignificant is the vast number that you actually aggregate by people clicking on the same things. So what we do get here is that every one single click or vote or opinion that you register with some post or upvote or whatever it is might in and by itself not mean anything. But aggregated, it may make for a fairly strong public signal as to what possibly is the right thing to do or right thing to believe or right thing to pursue and so forth and so far. And one thing we do know from social psychology is that when we are in doubt about what stands to take or what action to perform, then if we can't get any more information out of our immediate surroundings or environment, what we tend to do is to look at what other people are doing and then copying that behavior. It also has a term in social psychology. It's called social proof. And in many ways, that's a fairly rational thing to do because if things go right, then basically what we do is that we are feeding into other people's experiences and using them as guidelines to our decisions. But if they are somehow skewed or from the outset may not actually represent what people think, then we might actually get it to go the other way around, namely that we march the same wrong direction instead of walking the right direction. So social proof is extremely powerful as to align people sometimes positively, but if we can get derailed from the facts, if we sort of start off in the wrong direction. And registering your opinion like that in a what you could call a bubble hospitable environment where it doesn't, for instance, cost you very much to register your opinion about this and that, then that's a concern that we should at least address and possibly also see what we can do about, or at least get some experience with how we actually function in this new environment, since it is new to us in terms of registration of opinion.
The idea that we can all register and broadcast our opinion very easily sounds like something that could improve engagement and discussion between people. But it seems as though you're saying there's actually a tension because we can do it so easily, you can quickly have these huge herding effects where everyone just gravitates towards single, quite ungraded views on things.
Right. I think David hit it right on the head before. Since the 1940s, it's been known in political theory that we have homophily, that we tend to gravitate towards people that we actually already agree with. Now, recent studies by Cass Sunstein and others goes to show that we easily polarize. And so that means that if you take a group of people and ask them to deliberate, so assume you have a group of people who are like-minded in their views on politics or religion or whatnot, and you ask them to deliberate, then there is a tendency for the entire group to shift to a point of view that is more radical than any one of its members, such that the group will actually hold a stronger standpoint than individual members ever so often. If you pair that up with homophily and the easy registration of points of view, then at least there is a concern that you can align people fairly easily on the web by getting people to believe that everybody else believes such and so, even though people might be in doubt. But since the registration of my point of view doesn't cost very much, at least I could get an idea of what I apparently seems to be the case, what other people are believing. And if I'm in doubt, well, then I'll feed into social proof to get myself an answer, or getting enough information to actually deliberate, decide, and act on some issue that I find important.
David, I had a question for you. In your science piece, you talk about humanity being in the early stages of the rise of social algorithms. And I wondered if you might just share some thoughts on where you see this going, where you see social algorithms coming into our lives and impinging on our lives, and what these social and policy implications are that you see as being concerns.
Sure. I think, as you said, we're at the very early stages here. So I think one takeaway I should note is that the debate and the phenomenon about filter bubbles is not closed. This is really an important starting point, an important starting point for studying the evolution of, in this case, Facebook going into the future, establishes a baseline of sorts. But in fact, it also represents a much broader phenomenon because there is so much data being collected about us, and there's so many advances in the field of data science about making inferences about us, that our virtual worlds are starting to become quite customized. So what you would see when you search Google will be different from what I see. What you'll see if you go onto Amazon or another e-commerce vendor will be different. In other research, we've shown that you'll even see different products, you'll get different prices. And so some of the stuff around social algorithms is, unproblematic. I talk about, in my paper, I talk about that if you're searching for information about, let's say, fish and chips in London, you want to find out about a restaurant in London, not in Birmingham. So it's good that they customize that information based on where you are. It becomes a bit more problematic if you get different prices for goods than I do. And that raises certain kinds of equity issues. And there's a great line by a senator in the United States, a former senator, the late, great Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who said, "We're each entitled to our opinion, but we're not entitled to our own facts." The concerns about the filter bubbles is that we're going to end up getting more and more very distinctive sets of facts about how the world works. And in fact, we're all living in the same world and we have to live under the same set of policies. So I think that this presents a whole array of potential challenges going forward. And I think there are three sets of interests we should think about here. One is the interests of individuals The second is the interests of corporations that are minding these socio-technical systems like Facebook, Amazon, and so on. And then there are the interests of society. And actually, those are three distinct interests, and they may be aligned together or apart in different scenarios. So, for example, maybe the way Facebook perhaps filters stuff so you see stuff that you agree with makes you happier, makes you more engaged with the content in Facebook. You stay on Facebook longer. That makes Facebook happier because they make money off of every minute you're on Facebook. You feel good because you're seeing a world that confirms what you believe, but that may be terrible for society. Now, there may be other scenarios where, let's say, a vendor is trying to figure out, you're not that price sensitive or you're not that quality sensitive. So we can give you a higher price than we're giving someone else. And so we're going to jack up the price just for you because we know what your behavior is and that you're not price sensitive. You're not going to look at other websites and so on. That does raise certain concerns about equity, and there's clearly a big difference between the producer in that case and the consumer. And so, you know, each of these uses of the social algorithms will have very different normative and policy implications.
Can I ask a question about something else you raise in your piece, which is about whether some voices or topics get preferential treatment?
I enjoyed this paper on Facebook, but there are many important questions that are not addressed. And I think the filter bubble is an important question, but it's not the only question when we think about Facebook as a sphere for political conversation. And it may not even be the most important question. For example, we do not know if the algorithm incidentally privileges certain voices over others. Maybe men's posts are more likely to be promoted than women's or vice versa. Maybe people who are more educated are more likely to be promoted. Maybe cute pictures of cats are promoted over politics. And those are really important questions to know if Facebook algorithms are doing that, because it then has implications for the quality of the discourse on Facebook. And, you know, and I'm not saying that's the only thing Facebook is good for. In fact, its primary use is probably for friends just to keep up with each other. I mean, I guess that's debatable, but clearly one function it does play for us collectively is to facilitate a conversation about the state of the world. And we just don't even have the answers. We don't have the beginning of the answers of how good a job it's doing on those dimensions.
And that seems to raise this point about whether there should be more independent scientists looking at these algorithms. But then there are difficulties over the accessibility to the algorithms and who is actually going to do this work.
Well, that's right. And of more concern is access to the relevant data. Obviously, if you work within Facebook and you have the right permissions and so on, you have access that really we don't want people generally to have, right? And presumably even within Facebook, it is tightly controlled. But what we don't want is a model where the only people who can study the socio-technical systems are the people who control the socio-technical systems, because they do have an interest in what is found and what is not to be found. Many of these systems are somewhat permeable. Like, there's a lot of research. Probably the socio-technical system that has had the most research on it is Twitter, and that's because it is quite accessible. So, you know, we can go out and start scraping thousands of tweets in a few minutes if we wanted to. Lots of researchers have access to very, very large samples of Twitter. Facebook is tougher because it's much more of a secured site in terms of accessing data than Twitter is. There are ways of accessing samples of data. What one major way has been through, and I don't know, a lot of people don't fully realize this, but when they load apps onto their Facebook profiles, those apps get potentially a ton of access to information about them. That raises significant privacy concerns because often those permissions aren't just one time, but you say, all right, I'll use this app, and then the app and the users behind the apps can continue to harvest data from you forever thereafter unless you get rid of the app. But the good part is that researchers have used that pathway to study Facebook. Unfortunately, just at the end of April, Facebook sharply limited the data that you could access through the apps. And I think there were some legitimate privacy concerns, so I don't want to bash them for doing that. But it also then does create a problem that the only people can access the data are Facebook researchers and no one else can. And so there needs to be some way to create a bridge for scholars who want to study Facebook to garner more access to Facebook data, if only because, frankly, studies like this in the long run will be more credible if there can be more research that confirms these kinds of findings.
So, David, you mentioned that sometimes people are given different prices for products, and I'm not sure what you have to do to get pigeonholed as someone who doesn't mind paying more, but clearly no one wants to be that person. I wondered, as a switched-on consumer, is there anything you can do to try and avoid these effects?
Well, we had a paper out in the fall that actually got a fair amount of attention that quantified some of these effects. I think there are a few things. One, they're a bit of a hassle, and that's part of the reason why the system works for the e-commerce vendors. So, for example, you might switch browsers. So let's say if you search from your laptop, but then you also searched on your mobile phone, you might well get very different prices. And often, actually, we found mobile phone searches got better prices than desktops or laptops. You could switch browsers even within your laptop, because then your behavior might not be tracked across browsers or across different computers. Again, that depends if you're signed in. If you're signed into Amazon, it really doesn't matter where you are. They'll be able to identify you. But if there are other mechanisms of tracking you through cookies, cookies are like little programs on your computer that are registering where you surf, that information is often then subsequently used potentially against you. So you need to somehow outwit the cookies. You can also get rid of the cookies, and there are ways of doing that, although then the way the system is set up is that often creates great headaches as well. But I'd say being nimble and searching across browsers and platforms and trying signing in, trying not signing in, can sometimes outwit the system.
I'd love to get both of your thoughts actually on how big a deal you really see this stuff being, because it's by its nature pretty well confined to our virtual lives, and we still spend more of our lives, you know, not online, hopefully, or not doing anything very significant online anyway. I mean, you know, if it's just, you know, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, does that mean it's actually the worst it can be as a small problem?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily the worst. We've just seen the tip of the iceberg. We don't know yet, I actually think. It's easy to start doing it to sell people products that they can buy. So getting a good price on your new cell phone is something very tangible for you. However, how it exactly influences your point of view when it comes to politics, ideology, and other things, we have just seen this is just beginning. So it certainly depends on what sort of product that we are talking about. Some products are, harmless, and other products are less harmless. And you should realize, or we should realize, of course, that the platforms, the social platforms that we use, are not in the business of providing you with a platform for which you can sort of present your identity and get in touch with friends, albeit, of course, that's what you can do. But what they do is that they do want to sell you a product. And as David was saying before, the more you are online, the more money is going to be made. So their business model is not based on altruism, if you wish. It's based on totally different sets of premises, which are fine for what they are. But one shouldn't kid oneself to believe that they are basically in the business of enlightening you to become wiser as to health, wealth, and happiness, necessarily. So from that perspective, I think there is a concern to be raised here. And one other thing concern to be raised is the fact that it's fairly easy to manipulate these things. I mean, last year in August, there was a very interesting study in Science as well about some researchers that joined hands with a opinion aggregator system, ostensibly like Digit or Reddit, and they monitored the status of various comments over some 5-month period. And then what they did is that they rigged the setup in such a way that whenever a user left a comment, it was automatically rendered with either a positive upvote or a negative downvote or no vote at all. Now, here's just the key of that experiment. So if a comment received just a single upvote, the likelihood of receiving another upvote for the first user to see afterward was 32% relative to the control group. And one of the interesting things that they get out of this study is to say, look, be a little careful here, because one of the lessons from this experiment is basically quoting them saying, attempts to aggregate collective judgment and social choice could be easily manipulated with dramatic consequences for our markets, our politics, and our health. That's from Mushnick and Company 2013 in Science. So these scientists are actually somewhat concerned that this sort of manipulation is actually fairly easy, and you can easily rig these setups in such a way that you get social influence bias in various ways. And some of the consequences, maybe they're painting it a little tough or a little much, but some of the consequences may actually be out there for us not to see yet, but for us to see later.
Oh, I agree. I agree with everything Vince said. I would also note that we're not just talking about the virtual world, and I put just with quotes around it, because an increasing fraction of our lives is taking place in front of computer screens, and an increasing amount of our economic transactions are mediated by the internet. So it's actually a very large slice of what's going on. But in fact, this reflects a larger pattern of gathering data about people and trying to come up with customized messaging to individuals. So, you know, one of the big things in politics over the last decade has been how to customize political messages down to the individual level. Now, that's not necessarily happening on the internet, right? That may be in phone calls, that may be in literature that you're getting through the mail, but they're figuring out, well, you're this demographic, you have this, you know, there's tons of data about each of us that's being sold. I mean, I've seen these data catalogs, and it's really quite extraordinary the number of fields they have in the data, right? So, you know, we know what magazines you subscribe to, what cars you own, how much your house is worth. And out of that comes a lot of sophisticated modeling that then means that we might get exposed to different kinds of messaging in a way that is not meant to enable a broader conversation. It's meant to enable many smaller conversations. I'm not necessarily saying that's a horrible thing, but there are definite issues to be concerned about there. These kinds of modeling of consumer behaviors and figuring out how to utilize that information is something that is just pervasive, and not just in consumers, but for consumer information, but political information across many domains. And so this is just in the air now.
And I mean, just to supplement David on that one, this is one for you, the media as such. I mean, there were recent studies, all those goes to show, by Jonah Berger and his crew, the guy who wrote Contagious. What they found out that there were certain news stories that had got more social traction than other stories, in particular the sort of stories which had content that would include things about people being in awe or fascinated or something like that. That got a lot of social traction. So what's called positive action mobilizing emotions, those actually got traction. The same thing goes for some negative feelings, which are also activating, and that would be things like fear or anger. Whereas sadness, for instance, stories that had this sort of content would not get much traction. Now, of course, one could start speculating in, what sort of stories would actually provide a lot of traction? Well, if we know that that action mobilizing positive emotions, the ones that presume those get a lot of traction. Well, in a certain way, we could frame our stories to such an extent that they would actually conform to this pattern, or at least stimulate them such that you could get a lot of social traction that way. So even from a news perspective or from a media perspective, marketing campaigns as to what sort of stories could get traction based on their content would not be an uninteresting thing to know about either, nor actually, for that matter, to influence people.
How do we stay vigilant to what's going on with this and to keep abreast of anything that is going to become a concern for the public? I mean, David, I know you've talked about a need for these social critics.
Well, I think this goes back to the point that we need to continue to do studies like this, and that the capacity to do studies like this has to be fairly broad. That is, not just within Facebook, because this is very much a moving target. There are many things, important things the study did not look at, and that's not a criticism of the study, it's the reality of any study. We really want to do studies like this and maybe with different subsets of populations on Facebook, look at different dimensions of the discursive quality of Facebook and how the algorithm affects that. I think vigilance is the word, which is to say we need to continue to do work like this. This is an important study, but it should be one of many studies like this that happens forevermore, ideally, I hope. And the same goes with other domains, that is looking at e-commerce vendors, looking at Twitter, looking at other social media sites. And the good news is that there actually has been an explosion of interest in these areas. It's just that we're still very much wrestling with getting the kinds of access that are needed or that is needed to answer these questions. And Facebook is really important because people spend so much time on it. And it's a tougher nut to crack because it's less permeable than some of these other platforms.
How concerned do you think tech companies themselves are about the perception that they're manipulating our lives? Because there can be a tendency to see companies like Facebook as somewhat sinister.
Well, I think it's that they might have more than one answer to that question, and we might have more than one answer. One thing that has been registered as a concern by certain of these social platform vendors is the fact that they also do provide an outlet for things that we deem to be a little bit concerning. So, for instance, radicalism, extremism, and finding people like-minded with fairly radical points of view, that they can actually use the social media to this end as well. And then you're just selling a different sort of political product. It's just one with a fairly strong nature. So at least there has been voiced concerns from some of these different vendors that at least they should look into exactly what sort of mechanics or what sort of dynamics are they actually able to stimulate in unfortunate ways by their social media networks. But on the other hand, and this is a fine line to walk. On the other hand, of course, you also want to be able to let people talk about what they want to talk about. But then again, then you have to pair that up with a particular interest also, of course, in being a super highway for selling all sorts of products to all sorts of people. So it's a very complex sort of concerns that factors into that kind of question and the kind of answers that they are willing to provide for different parts of this particular question.
I would just add that I think there is definitely some worries about appearing to be manipulative, and I think this is certainly one of the things that I would guess is being wrestled with in corporate offices is the potential creepiness factor when it becomes obvious to consumers that they're somehow being tracked to sell them goods, as well as the fairness factor, that is, to what extent are consumers going to be happy when they find out that someone else got a better deal than they did. And so I'm sure that's being wrestled with. I'm curious what those conversations are like, but I'm sure that they're evaluating what the trade-offs are in terms of short-run profits versus long-run reputation that may in turn reduce long-run profits.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Let's take a look at what's been in the science news in the past week. Hannah, what's caught your eye?
Well, there was a really interesting study out looking at why we have more deaths and instances of certain diseases and illnesses over the winter. So it was talking about things like heart disease, diabetes, even some psychiatric conditions, which are all known to reliably peak during the winter months. And this in the past has often been just put down to colder weather, people having more coughs and colds, maybe even our own lifestyles becoming more sluggish and unhealthy. But the latest study suggests it might actually be down to our own immune systems. So the study was looking at the way gene activity changes throughout the year in our white blood cells. And the team at the University of Cambridge took samples of blood from 16,000 people across the world, looking both in the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere, and took the samples at 3 months intervals across the year. And they found that there were certain genes whose activity peaked in the winter and dropped off in the summer, and certain genes that showed the opposite effect. And the overall story appeared to be that the immune system was generally becoming more active and robust over the winter months. That makes sense because we'd want to be able to fight off infections like colds and flu that are more common in the winter. But they're saying that there could, in fact, be a flip side to this. And when our immune system's more active, inflammation's more likely to happen, which can cause immune cells to attack our own tissues. And that could, in the worst cases, tip people over into a state of disease. So it could actually trigger heart attacks and strokes and diabetes, and even some of these conditions like schizophrenia and depression, which we're now starting to think there's a link between these conditions and inflammation in the body. Ian, I believe you've got some important information from the science world about the dress. So this is the viral sensation, the dress that about half the population seems to see as blue and black and half seem to see as white and gold. I think scientists have made some progress on understanding why we don't all see it in the same light.
I think they're getting closer to an answer if they haven't got anything definitive. This was a group at MIT with a guy called Bevel Conway and some others who wanted to try and understand why it is that people are seeing this dress in the different ways, the very different ways that they do see it. They started off just doing surveying more than 1,000 people about, you know, some of them had never seen this before, some of them have seen it. What color is this? How would you describe it? And so on. They actually found you get three different groups. The majority of people do see it as blue-black. Then you have about 30% odd seeing it as white-gold, and about a 10% see it as blue-brown. But what comes out of the study that they've done is this idea that what may be going on is that it really depends on what they call this sort of potentially an internal model of how you perceive things visually. So the theory goes, and they've got some supporting evidence for this, is that if your brain is pretty much biased to seeing things in artificial lighting, so incandescent lighting, that light has more red wavelengths in it, more longer wavelengths in it. So when you see something, your brain will subtract the red wavelengths from it and tell you that's actually the real colors of the thing you're looking at. And in this case, if you think that dress was illuminated by artificial light, once you take away the sort of reddish colors, then you're more likely to see it as blue black. On the other side, if your sort of internal model, as they call it, is more set up or is more developed to be biased towards thing having natural illumination, the light we see in the outside world has more blue light in it, more shorter wavelengths. Once you subtract those to get what your brain thinks is the true color, when you take away that sort of bluish light, you see it more as white gold. Now, why would different people see this in different ways? Why would you see these stark differences and people just completely disagreeing on what color this flipping dress is? Well, one idea that's been thrown out there, and it was Bevel Conway who did it, was saying, well, maybe there's something to do with chronotype here. Maybe there's something to do with the larks and owls, the people who awake in the daytime hours, in the sunlight hours. Maybe their system, through their experiences of life, has become more suited to assuming a natural illumination for things. And if you've got people who are staying up all hours, getting up later in the day, maybe their system is more biased to assuming artificial illumination for an object. It's just an idea. But something that came out of their study was that women and older people were more likely to see the dress as white gold. And that's the same group that is also more likely to be those guys who are awake in the sunlight hours, with men and the younger people being more biased towards being these late to bed types. So there's some kind of little suggestion in there, but it's early days on that. They don't have a definite answer. One thing I did like was that they found that about 10 to 20% of the people they looked at could actually switch the image in their mind. So just by looking at the image, they could say, okay, they would have a default that they would say, okay, it's white, gold, or blue, black. But they could then stare at it for a bit and see it in the other colors, which is what you can do with some of these other visual optical illusions where there might be a face and an animal or something that you can resolve two different images and you just have to choose which. Another neat thing they did was they gave people better cues on what the lighting was. Now, when they recreated the image, they tried to recreate the image of this dress, and they believed that what you have in the image that went viral was a big window that's allowing a lot of natural sunlight in, but also some artificial lighting coming from the shop or the building where the dress is. So you have these two different light sources on the dress at the same time. So what they then did is they took a sort of digital copy of the dress and they put it on a digital female model, but then they put that female model in a scene where there were better lighting cues. So if it was natural sunlight, her skin would have a natural illumination, so would the scenery behind them. And when you do that, almost everybody sees this image as white gold. When you do the opposite, when you make it look like it's illuminated only by artificial light, people will flip to see it the blue-black way, regardless of, you know, how they saw it in the first place. So you can get people to change their position on what color this is. So it seems that with those extra cues, you can get people to see the dress one way or the other and kind of override this assumption that we're making when we see that based on the very little information that's in the picture, which is this sort of the heart of the ambiguity that makes it such a divisive image.
And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to David Lazar, Vincent Hendricks, and Ian Sample. From me, Hannah Devlin, and all at the Science Team, thanks for listening.